choose a topic. The elders usually choose a topic or a book of the Bible or something like that, and call on different men, sometimes draft different men to work up some material and present on that topic. And so this quarter we're talking about stewardship, the idea of stewardship from the Bible, with some material that was taught in a class that people really enjoyed, got really good comments about that class. Kevin and Gary, did you teach it? Kevin and Gary? Kevin and Matt. Yeah, Matt. Kevin and Matt taught it and just really got rave reviews. And so we wanted to try to bring that material to the congregation at large. And so that's what we're trying to do. It's my turn this week. This particular quarter, I think all the elders are participating, all four of us. And so today is my turn to present some material about stewardship. A little out of sorts today. I woke up this morning and realized I don't have my outline ready to hand out. You know? I've been working on it, and I thought, oh, well, better get on up and get it ready to hand out. And so it's going to be passed out in just a minute. That's one of the things that we try to do is make the material available to everybody, at least in outline form, so that everybody can take it home and look at it later. Or maybe use it, maybe incorporate it in a sermon or a Bible class that you're teaching. And then I walked out and forgot my Bible. And I was going to use one. This one is even in worse shape than this one. But fortunately, I texted Cherry and she was able to bring it to me. So anyway, I try to settle down a little bit and present the material today. We want to begin with a word of prayer. And then after the prayer, the material will be distributed. Okay, Bryce is going to lead us today. All right, so my topic is, and I've copied 100. I've got 100 copies, and so I don't know how many people we've got in the room today, but some may have to share. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, my topic is stewards in the New Testament. So if you look at the word steward and look at how it's used in the New Testament, you'll find that it occurs several times, not a whole lot of times, but several times anyway. And I've got those listed here, at least some of them listed here in the first section. And so we're not going to take the time to read all of these, but we'll take note of them as we begin nonetheless. So Luke chapter 12, verse 42, the Lord said, "Who then is the faithful and wise steward or faithful and sensible steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time?" And so Jesus uses this concept of stewardship and the responsibilities of disciples under that figure. There's the parable of the unjust steward in Luke chapter 16. We talked about this parable not too long ago on Sunday night, and so we won't spend a whole lot of time on it. But you remember that there was a rich man who had a steward or a manager, he's called in the New American Standard Bible. And that manager was not managing the estate very well. He was squandering his master's possessions. And the day of judgment came, or the day of accountability came, when the steward was going to have to answer to his master for his mismanagement of the estate. And so he took measures to sort of ensure his future. Now, we might question his methods, but actually the master commends him for his acting wisely. And so the idea of steward occurs in some of the Psalms, and not just in that Psalm, but in other Psalms as well. We've talked about, not Psalms, but parables. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus tells a parable in which the master divides a certain amount of money up between three servants. To one servant he gives 5 talents, to one he gives 2, to one he gives 1. And these are to manage that money. And he expects those servants, I don't know that they're called stewards, but the idea is they're managing the money on behalf of the owner of the estate. And so they're kind of doing the work of a steward, maybe in a limited way, but But it seems as though that they're doing the work of the steward. And they're expected to increase the value of the estate through their work. So anyway, there's the concept of stewardship, or managing what belongs to another, managing what belongs to the master, in some parables like that. Erastus is identified as the city steward or chamberlain, or some versions may say treasurer. So he's managing. And so here's, this is not a household situation. The concept of managing what belongs to another then is transferred to a civil official. Here's a person that manages the money that belongs to the city or to the government. So he's a government official, and he's managing what ultimately belongs to the people, I suppose. But he's a steward on behalf of the city or the people. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, we find that stewards are to be or preachers or apostles. Paul is considering himself as an apostle here. He's a steward of the mysteries of God, and he's conscientious and wants to be faithful in carrying out his duty. We're going to look at that in more detail later. Paul had a stewardship entrusted to him, and so as an apostle, he has the responsibility of handling the responsibility his master has given him properly and effectively. So he describes his work as a stewardship. And we're going to look at that in more detail later. In Ephesians chapter 1, and I've just kind of quoted a portion of that passage in the outline. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. He made known to us the mystery of his will according to his kind intention, which he purposed in him, with a view to the administration or dispensation suitable to the fullness of time. And that's the word stewardship. So it seems that the idea here is that contained in the mystery of God's will is God's plan, in which he manages the events that take place over time in history, working toward the fullness of time when all things are summed up in Christ. And so he's managed the time, he's managed the events, and eventually we reach the fullness of time when Christ comes into the world and establishes his kingdom, and now we live in the administration of the messianic kingdom. Children might be under the guidance of a steward. That's the sixth use there in the list anyway. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 2, and we're going to refer to that one later as well. Paul speaks of the stewardship of God's grace, which was given to him. Ephesians 3 and verse 2. Paul was made a minister or a servant according to the stewardship bestowed on me. And so there you have that combination, servant and steward. A steward in a household is a servant, but he's a particular kind of servant. Not all servants were stewards, but stewards were usually servants or slaves. And so in the ancient world, slaves were not necessarily given the most menial tasks. Sometimes they were given great responsibility and had a good deal of freedom as far as that's concerned. How to manage the money or invest the money or spend the money, those kinds of things. Timothy was to occupy himself with the stewardship of God. Elders are God's stewards. Titus chapter 1 and verse 7, and time permits, we'll come back to that one. And Christians are to use their gifts as good stewards. I suppose in most presentations during the quarter, there'll be some overlap. Matt got us started in a great way the first week, talking about stewardship and the idea, the concept of stewardship. And then David last week talked about stewards from the Old Testament. But before we look at specific examples of stewards in the New Testament, let's just review the responsibility of stewards in general. A steward is a servant. We said a moment ago, but he's a specific kind of servant. He's given the responsibility of managing the house, or he governs the house, or he takes care of the house. And he might be given charge over many areas of the house. It may include the finances of the master. And that's the idea back in Luke chapter 16 in the parable of the unjust steward and some of the other other parables that involve stewards. The steward is managing the finances of the house, the money in the house, the master's money. In fact, it seems in Luke chapter 16 that the master doesn't even know the day, you know, day to day what the guy is doing with his money. He's mismanaging it. And when, again, the day of accountability comes along, the steward realizes, oh no, now he's going to find out what I've been doing. And so he's so trusted by the manager that the manager really doesn't even know from day to day what's being done. But anyway, he's managing the financial affairs of the master. But it might also include managing the children. And so look at Luke chapter 12, verse 42. The Lord said, "Who then is the faithful and sensible steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time?" And so I think I jumped ahead of myself a little bit and said he might manage the children, which is true, but here he manages the other servants. And so a steward manages the finances of the house, but he might be given the responsibility of managing the other servants. Okay, all right, I'm going to give you this job, and I'm going to give you two or three that job, and then you go on this mission and do this and come back and report. And so he's managing not just the finances, but maybe even other servants as well. In Galatians chapter 4, we find that a steward might also manage the children. And so verse 1 says, "Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything, but he is under guardians and managers," or stewards is the word, as the footnote indicates. "The son, even though he's the heir of the entire estate, when he's a boy, he's under the guardianship or under the oversight of a steward, a manager." And so the steward might manage money, but he's also managing people and taking care of other people. He's directing the servants. He even has, at least in some cases, the responsibility over the children to make sure that they're raised right, to make sure that they learn what they have to learn, that they're disciplined in the right way, that they, you know, that they're being raised appropriately. And so that might fill out, in some ways, our concept of the work of a steward. And so in the New Testament, the idea of stewardship or manager of a state, manager of what belongs to another, is transferred to Christians and their responsibilities. We are all servants in God's family. You know, the church is described as the family of God. And so the idea of stewardship, I mean, it's just an easy transfer, isn't it? It's just an easy comparison. You might remember the statement in Hebrews chapter 3 that Jesus was faithful as a son over God's house, but Moses was faithful as a servant in God's house. We're all servants in God's family. And as servants in God's family, we're given responsibilities, the responsibility of managing what has been put under our charge, whatever that might be. And as we've seen, stewards, you know, literal stewards, were given responsibility over various things, money or children or servants. And so in the family of God, servants might be given responsibility over one thing or another. And some Christians, some in the family of God, are given special duties. They're placed under, or they have the responsibility of special duties. And they're under an obligation to carry those things out to the best of their ability. Well, we can say that all of us are responsible for managing well the gifts that God has given us. We're going to talk more in more detail about money in the course of the lecture program. But I like Ezekiel chapter 15. No, that's incorrect. Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 15 and following. God talks about the blessings that he's bestowed upon Israel, and he says to them, "You trusted in your beauty." He's comparing Israel to a beautiful woman, and she's dressed well, and she has jewelry on, and she just looks great. "But you trusted in your beauty and played the harlot because of your fame, and you poured out your harlotries on every passerby who might be willing to You took some of your clothes and made for yourself high places of various colors and played the harlot on them, which should never come about or happen. You also took your beautiful jewels and made of my gold and my silver, which I had given you, and made for yourself images that you may play the harlot with them. And you took your embroidered cloth and covered them and offered my oil and my incense before them. Also my bread, which I gave you. Fine flour, oil, and honey with which I fed you, you would offer before them for a soothing aroma, so it happened, declares the Lord. So this is my gold that I gave you. I gave it to you to use it appropriately. Look what you did with it. This is my bread that I gave you, and look what you did with it. And so that's a good passage, I think. It's good to me anyway. Illustrates that. Look, we're just managers of what belongs to God. We have money in our pocket or in our bank account. But this God would say, this is my money that I've given you. What are you doing with it? What are you spending it on? This is my clothing that I've given to you. So if we can learn that concept, well, that might help us manage these things appropriately. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16, Paul says that we are to redeem the time. And so as Christians, we are stewards of our time. I think we're going to deal with that in more detail later on. But how do we manage the time that God has given us? What are we using our time to accomplish or to do? And so that's a legitimate question. In 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 10, and this has been brought out earlier in our lectures, Christians are to be managers of the various gifts that God has given them. As each one has received a special gift, employ it as serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Whoever speaks, you know, if he has that gift of speaking, maybe a teacher or a preacher, you're to do so as one speaking the utterances of God. Now you take things very seriously. You need to speak as though you're speaking God's utterances, which really is what you ought to be doing as you preach the word and apply it in a consistent and appropriate way. And then he goes on to mention other gifts as well, but I think we'll deal with that maybe later on. As husbands, you know, a husband, you know, he's to consider his wife as a gift from the Lord. The book of Proverbs tells us this is your God's gift to you. Okay, you need to deal with her as a gift, as God's gift. And so that might affect the way we treat our wives or our husbands. And as parents, God has given us children. And so how are we managing that responsibility? Are we doing it well, or is this just kind of a slipshod, sort of haphazard sort of thing with us raising our children? No, God has given us these children, and we have a responsibility to manage them in a way that pleases God. One day we'll have to give an account for that. Just like the unjust steward in Luke 16 realized that, okay, the day is coming when I'm going to have to give an account. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I hope that doesn't happen to us in regard to our families. As I said a moment ago, especially elders, Titus chapter 1, verse 7, are given the responsibility of taking care of the church. I hope to come back to that later. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, we're told to glorify God in our bodies. All right, God has given us a wonderful body. All right, it works great. Now, how are we taking care of it? Are we abusing it with all sorts of, you know, alcohol or tobacco or drugs or, you know, are we abusing it? Are we mistreating it? You know, we're to glorify God in our bodies. Our bodies are sort of a conduit through which we bring glory to God. And we would no more desecrate the body, which is the temple of the Holy Spirit. That's the whole point of 1 Corinthians 16, or 6 verses 19 and 20. Can you imagine someone desecrating the temple of the Lord? You know, just throwing all sorts of refuse on it and just letting it fall into disrepair and abusing it in some way, using it for purposes for which it was not intended. But, you know, are we doing that with our bodies? Okay, we're to be managers of the body. We take care of it. And keep it so that it is useful in God's service. Well, here's another thing that we might not think about very often. When we were created, when the human beings were created, they were given dominion over the earth. All right, you've got dominion over the birds of the sky and the fish in the sea, and you know the and God has given us this wonderful earth. In Genesis 2, verse 15, Adam and Eve were placed in the garden with the responsibility to work it and keep it. Can you imagine what God's reaction would be if he showed up one day there at the Garden of Eden and the garden was just in complete disrepair? I mean, just ruined. What are you doing with my garden that I gave you? Have you been taking care of it? I gave it to you to dress it and keep it, or to work it and keep it, and you've ruined it. Look at the earth around us. Now, I'm not an environmental extremist. But I think God has given us a good earth. Well, we ought to take care of it. You know, several years ago, I guess it's back in maybe the 1980s, Lake Erie was so polluted that it caught on fire. The lake caught on fire. The lake was burning. And there are places in the world today, you can't breathe the air without a mask. Is that taking care of the earth God gave us to live in? Again, you know, I'm not an environmentalist extremist, but you know, I don't think we ought to just close our eyes and just ruin the water and ruin the air and just... Now, God has given us earth, and He's put in the earth all kinds of materials that we can use to live our lives, to build shelter for ourselves, to warm ourselves and clothe ourselves and food to eat and all that. All those resources are there for us to use. And yet, at the same time, this is God's world. Oh, we need to have some concern about taking care of it. Okay, maybe enough for that. Well, what are some of the examples of good stewards in the New Testament, or just examples of stewards? As we said a moment ago, we talked a little bit about the parable of the unjust steward, and there are other examples of stewards in the parables of Jesus. The Bible has something to say about the way we use our money, or the way we use His money, God's money. And that more will be said about that later on, and so I'm not going to go into a lot of that. But just say using it in the wrong way is going to create problems for us, eternal problems for us. But using it in the right way will help us go to heaven. And so we need to have a good understanding of the right way to use the money that God has given us. Well, I've chosen Jesus as an example of a good steward. And it may be difficult for us to think of Jesus as a steward, a servant who's given responsibility over what belongs to another. But Jesus did take on the form of a servant, Philippians chapter 2 tells us. And He was responsible for doing the will of His Father. John chapter 6 tells us, I've come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of Him who sent me. And the Luke chapter 2 reference has to do with Jesus as a 12-year-old boy in the temple. Remember that story? Jesus is separated from His family. They're on their way back home from Jerusalem. After traveling 3 days, they realize, well, where's Jesus? They go back to Jerusalem, they find Him in the temple, and He says to them, well, didn't you know that I must be about my Father's business? And so here, that's a steward, isn't it? I'm about my Father's business. I've been given work to do by my Father, and I'm supposed to be carrying out that work in a way that will please Him. And so, yeah, I think we can accurately talk about Jesus as a steward, and as we might expect, as we think about His work in this capacity, He fills it out flawlessly. Well, think about Jesus and money. How did Jesus acquire money? He did have some money, or had access to money. For a good period of time, He must have been a carpenter. He doesn't begin His public ministry until He's 30 years old, or about 30 years old. Mark chapter 6 and verse 3, the people that know Jesus, that knew Him as He was growing up in the city of Nazareth said, is this not the carpenter? And so Jesus was a carpenter, must have learned carpentry from His Father. And so He may have supported Himself and helped support His family, His mother and brothers and sisters as a carpenter. And so He did have some money or acquire some money. During His ministry, Luke chapter 8 and verse 3 tells us that Some of the women that accompanied Jesus were contributing to his support and the support of the disciples out of their private means. And so some of these women must have been rather well off, or at least had access to some money. And they would contribute to Jesus as he's doing his work and his disciples as they were going from place to place teaching. I suppose that during the course of the 3-year ministry of Jesus, Peter and others may have brought money into the group through their work by fishing or maybe doing some other things that the disciples did in order to make a little bit of money. In John 12, we know that Judas was the treasurer of the group. And so we do know that they had some money. They didn't have a lot of money, I'm sure, but they did have some money to buy food and clothing and lodging, perhaps, and things like that. And so we may not know how much money Jesus had access to, but we do know what he taught about the management of money. And so he said things like, don't lay up treasure on the earth. And so he had some money, okay, but he's not laying up treasure on the earth. That's Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 and following. He says that a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Luke chapter 12 and verse 15. He says it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 19, verses 23 and 24. And in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35, in a quotation not found in the Gospels, it's more blessed to give than to receive. So that's what Jesus taught us about money. Don't lay treasure on the earth. Understand there's more to life than material things. Be generous, be living, willing to give. It's more blessed to give than to receive, and those kinds of things. And so, you know, if we follow that teaching, well, then we'll be making good use of our money. Think about Jesus and time. How does he manage his time? You might be able to think of occasions, but I couldn't think of any. We really don't read very much about Jesus having leisure time, do we? Now, he went to a wedding. John, the second chapter, he went to a wedding, apparently a guest at the wedding. And, of course, he does a miracle there. So even when he's not out teaching, you know, he's still doing the work, isn't he? And I can't think of an instance, and maybe you can, maybe I'm missing one, that involved Jesus participating in any form of recreation. I heard not too long ago, probably a couple of years ago now, that every culture has had a bat and ball game. It might be baseball, like in our culture, or softball, or cricket, but every culture has had a bat and ball game. And you don't ever read about Jesus playing ball, do you? or doing anything, just by way of recreation. Not that that's wrong, but we just don't have a record. And I'm sure it's the nature of the record and the nature of the mission of Jesus that we just don't read about those things. He uses time to fulfill his mission. Luke 10, 19, verse 10, Jesus says, I've come to seek and save the lost. I'm on a mission. And I've come for a particular purpose. I've come to seek and save the lost. And so that's what we read about Jesus doing. In Mark chapter 10, the crowd, in Mark chapter 1, crowds of people were coming to Jesus. And you know, early one morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up and he left the house. He went away to a secluded place, was praying there, and Simon and his companions searched for him. They found him and said, everyone's looking for you. And he said to them, let's go somewhere else, to the towns nearby, so that I may preach there also. For that's what I came to do. I came to teach. And so it seems that Jesus is so focused on his mission and fulfilling his mission that he really didn't have time for much else. Of course, again, he's a special case. He taught publicly. In Luke chapter 4, he goes to the synagogue in Nazareth and he teaches a crowd of people there. He teaches privately. He's sitting down by a well, tired from his journey one day, and a woman comes up to the well. It's in Samaria. And so just a one-on-one conversation, but he's teaching. He's taking advantage of that time and opportunity. In Mark chapter 8 and verse 2, Jesus, on that occasion, feeds 4,000 people. But the point I want to make is found in verse 2. Jesus says, I feel compassion for the people because they've remained with me now 3 days. He's been teaching for 3 days. Now, I don't know that that means 72 hours straight, but for 3 days he's been teaching and they've been listening. And they really haven't had enough to eat. And so he performs this miracle to feed them. The feeding is sort of in support of the teaching in a way, or it's in service to the teaching. It's not we're going to draw people in with food and then teach them. No, we're going to teach and, oh, they don't have anything to eat. Let's feed them. But anyway, Jesus is using his time teaching, finding people, whether it's publicly or privately, sowing that seed into good and honest hearts. We know that he spent time in prayer. Luke 5 and verse 16. He would often slip away privately and pray, especially before critical times in his life. The Garden of Gethsemane perhaps is the prime example of that. But Luke 6 and verse 12. It was at this time he went off to the mountain to pray. He spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also named apostles. What do you think he was praying about during that night? Now, in the morning, he's going to call his disciples and he's going to choose 12. So what do you think he was praying about? He's quite confident he's praying about the choice of those 12, at least in part. Now, he might have prayed about other things as well. He spent time with his disciples, training them to do the work he would send them out to do. And John 18 and verse 2, Judas leads the soldiers to the Garden of Gethsemane because he knew Jesus would often go there with his disciples. Jesus had been there lots of times, and Judas would have been among them, just spending time with his disciples, teaching them, training them, preparing them for the work they had to do. And so it seems that Jesus is very much aware of the limited amount of time that he has, and to use it as efficiently as possible to accomplish as much as possible. And in the end, he's able to say that he had accomplished the work that his Father had given him to do. John 17, 4, I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you've given me to do. So we've talked about Jesus and money, Jesus and time. How about Jesus and family? We don't read a whole lot about Jesus and family. He's not married. He doesn't have his own children. And so he doesn't have those responsibilities, obviously. And we read only about a few interactions that he has with his family. We know that he's subject to his parents. Luke chapter 2, verse 51. After this episode at the temple, when he's 12 years old, he's subject to his parents. And so he's a good son and he obeys his parents. And, you know, as children should do, they submit themselves. He submitted himself to his father and mother. His focus is clearly on his work during his teaching years. In John 2, it seems that he rebuffs his mother. And so they've run out of wine at the wedding feast, and his mother comes to him, and, hey, can you do something about this? Look, woman, my time is not yet. And so he seems to rebuff her a little bit. When his parents come to him, he's in the house, you remember, they're concerned about him, and his response is, who is my mother and brothers? The children of God. And so, in a way, he rejects them. Now, I don't mean he just turns his back on them, but he's simply saying, look, my commitment is greater to my brothers and sisters in God's family than even my own physical brothers and sisters and mother. But at the cross, Jesus, who is the oldest son, provides for his mother. In John 19, Jesus is on the cross, and John 19, this is verse 25. Therefore, the soldiers did these things, but standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, presumably John, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. This is one of the, I might have it wrong, I guess, but this is at the beginning of the cross. This is one of the first things, maybe not the very first thing that he says, but first thing, among the first things. He's taking care of his family. He's taking care of his mother. He's the oldest son. It's been speculated that Joseph must have died, perhaps, or he's just not in the picture. And so Jesus, his oldest son, takes care of his mother. And John takes her into his home. So what might we conclude from all of that? Well, Jesus, again, not a husband or a father, but he did have some obligations to keep as a member of the family. And in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4, we're told that children are to make some return to their parents. And so Jesus does this for his mother when he gives her to the care of John. Well, there are several other good New Testament examples of stewards. In Acts chapter 4, we've been studying from the book of Acts. Barnabas is a good steward, isn't he? In lots of different ways. But you might remember in Acts chapter 4, Barnabas is among those who had a piece of property and sold it and gave the money to distribute among his brothers and sisters in Christ who were needy. That's Acts chapter 4. That's verse 36. Barnabas, or Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who is also called Barnabas by the apostles, which translated means son of encouragement, who owned a tract of land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. It's being a good steward, isn't it? Now, by way of contrast, you go down in Acts chapter 5, you find Ananias and Sapphira. They're lying about the money they receive from the sale of the land. They apparently not only want to keep back part of it for themselves, which really would have been all right for them to do. They lie about it. And so that's really a contrast to the kind of faithful stewardship that we find in Barnabas. In Acts chapter 11, we find the church at Antioch doing something similar. They're told that a famine is going to come upon, you know, the world at that time. And so they gather some money together and send it to the brethren in Judea to help them in the famine. So that's Acts 11, verses 27 through 30. And so this has to do with the group, the whole group, the church at Antioch, taking some of their money and sharing it with those, especially of those brethren who are in need. You can contrast that with the church at Corinth. A little bit later on, Paul is collecting money for needy Christians back in Judea. Apparently they've fallen into need again. And so the church at Corinth, he says, you were one of the first ones to say, yeah, we'll give for that. The next year, Paul has to go back and say, okay, come on now. You promised you would give. You know, and so he kind of has to cajole them into giving or encourage them or maybe even rebuke them, because they had not made good on their promise. And so that's a kind of a negative example. But I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Paul. Paul is a good steward in God's family. Paul knew that money was necessary to live, and he sometimes had plenty of money. Sometimes he didn't have enough money. He talks about that. I've learned how to live with a lot or in abundance. And I've learned how to get along in need as well. That's Philippians chapter 4. He received money from churches at times. The church at Philippi sent him money on occasion. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 8, he says, I robbed other churches, taking wages from them. And so other churches would support Paul in his work as well. Sometimes he provided for himself, making tents. But he had learned the secret of good stewardship. Be content. Be content. Be content with what you have. Live within your means. You know, try to think about opportunities where you can help those who are in need or less fortunate. And so he learned all of those lessons. And so no doubt he was a good steward of the money God had given him. I don't know much about Paul's family life. I kind of wonder if his conversion to the gospel, his conversion to Christ, might have caused some problems in his family. That wouldn't be hard to imagine. But he really doesn't talk a whole lot about his father, or his mother, or brothers, or sisters, or anything like that. But we do know what Paul taught about the family. So Ephesians chapter 5 talks about husbands and wives. We're going to talk more about that later, so I'll try to refrain from getting into that. But he taught us how to be good stewards in our families. We do know a lot about Paul and the work God gave him to do. Now, Paul was an apostle, and so he was sent out. That's what an apostle is. He's someone who is sent out. Now, we're not apostles, and so we do the work sometimes right here in a particular location. But Paul was an apostle But he had even among the apostles, had a special mission. And that's going to the Gentiles. And so that's, he considered that his stewardship. This is the responsibility the master has given him. So how is he carrying it out? And really, it's in this context that Paul uses stewardship language most frequently. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, for example, in verse 17, if I do this work voluntarily, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. And now Paul didn't think of himself as a volunteer preacher. No, God called him. And God placed an obligation upon him. In Galatians, he would say, God set me apart from my mother's womb to do this work. And here he says, woe is unto me if I do not preach the gospel. I have a special obligation because I've been specially chosen to do this work. And so I have a stewardship from God. Look at Colossians chapter 1, where he talks about this again. Colossians 1 and verse 25. Of this church, he's spoken of the church in the previous verse, and he says, of this church I was made a minister according to the stewardship from God bestowed on me for your benefit, so that I might fully carry out the preaching of the word of God. And so, clearly, Paul thought of himself as under obligation to teach the gospel. He'd been chosen especially for that. He had been assigned this work. So just like the master of an estate might call a servant and says, you're going to be my steward. He's not giving him a choice. He's telling him, this is your responsibility. That's the way Paul considered his work as an apostle. And it was important to him that he do it well. So 1 Corinthians chapter 4 says, let a man regard us in this manner as servants of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found faithful or trustworthy. I want to be a faithful steward in carrying out my mission. Now, people are criticizing Paul about his work as an apostle. He says, but to me, it is a very small thing that I may be examined by you critics out there, or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself. I'm conscious of nothing against myself as far as the fulfilling of my duty as an apostle is concerned. But I'm not by this acquitted, but the one who examines me is the Lord. The Lord, my master. The day of accountability is coming for me, and he's going to render a judgment in my case. Well, of course, there is a lesson for us to learn in all of that. You know, we have been given the word, and we need to take care of it. We're managers. We're stewards of this word in this world. We are the stewards of the word. How are we doing with it? How are we managing it? How are we distributing it? How well are we teaching it? It'd be difficult to find any fault with Paul and his commitment or the execution of his work. He taught publicly and privately. He taught men, women, rich, poor, Jew, Gentile, slave and free, sophisticated, unsophisticated. He taught in season and out of season. He taught in the company of others or alone. He taught when free or imprisoned. He looked for opportunity, asked others to pray for opportunity for him. And in Acts 20 and verse 26, he says, I consider myself free from the blood of all men. I've been doing it as to the best of my ability. How about us? How are we doing as stewards of God's word? Well, Paul encourages Timothy to do his work as a good steward. I'll make a point. Now, Timothy does take on the work voluntarily. He's not in the same situation that Paul was in, but still, he is to take care of his work as a good steward, which leads me to this point. Bible teachers have a great responsibility. Whether you're a preacher, a Bible class teacher, whether you're teaching adults or little children, you're in a position of management, managing God's word. We need to use our ability to fulfill the work. We need to be prepared for our classes or sermons. We must handle the word correctly. Oh, it's hard to overemphasize that. Handle the word correctly. All right? So I could have a lot to say about that, but I don't have the time to say it. And we need to live in a manner consistent with what we're teaching. That's just being good managers. And then finally, elders are to be good stewards as well. Oh, that's a sobering thought, I think. The day of accountability is coming for us as well. The overseer must be above reproach as God's steward. We've been given the charge of caring for the family. All right? You remember the statement in 1 Timothy chapter 3, if a man can't take care of his own family, or how can he take care of the church of God? That's our business as elders, to take care of the church of God. That is the people. The steward is expected to manage the estate so that it grows and prospers. The elders are expected to manage the church so that the people thrive and prosper spiritually. All right? That's our work. We are to manage this congregation so that the people here grow and thrive and prosper and develop spiritually. That's my work. It's Alan's work. It's Eric's work. It's Simon's work. That's a pretty sobering thought. You know, the one talent man, he didn't lose any money. He just didn't make the estate prosper. He didn't bring any increase. I'm afraid there may be some elders out there that they're not losing any. They're just not showing any increase. I'm not talking about numbers. I'm talking about in the spiritual development of the people. And so the elder is to do what makes for a peaceful situation so that the people can feed and grow and develop. He is to feed and oversee the teaching of the people so that they might increase in knowledge and spiritual maturity. He's to provide opportunities for edification. The church should be better off because of his management. So at the end of the day, you know, when an elder gets to the end of his life or the end of his tenure as an elder, he should be able to look back and say, I think the church is better off for what we did. I think we've developed. We might, in fact, you might have decreased in number, but you might increase spiritually under some circumstances. But the church should be better off because of the management of the elders. Jesus asks, who will be a faithful steward who has faithfully discharged his duties when the master comes? Who's going to be a faithful and wise steward when the master comes? That's a good question, isn't it? How about us? Will we be found faithful as stewards when the master comes? Appreciate your attention today.